Claude Shannon, in 1948, wrote a paper which essentially not only founded the field of information theory, but put it all to a running start, and essentially contained all of the fundamental theorems of information theory were in that paper, or at least the two most fundamental. And here is a quote from that paper. "The fundamental problem of communication is that of reproducing at one point, either exactly or approximately, a message selected at another point." So for quantum information theory, this is going to be the same problem, but here, either the means of reproduction or the message is fundamentally quantum. So you can ask, like Charlie Bennett did, why people didn't, instantly upon information's discovery, ask the question, what happens in the quantum case? Well, I think it was somewhat of a disconnect between two different professions. So this is a quote from John Pierce in 1973, and he says, "I think I've never met a physicist who understood information theory. I wish the physicists would stop talking about reformulating information theory and would give us the general expression for the capacity of a channel with quantum effects taken into account rather than a number of special cases." Now, there are a couple of points I want to make about this quote and the paper it came from. It came from in 1948, the IEEE Transactions on Information Theory ran a series of retrospective articles, and this is from one of them. And the two points. First point was that we still don't have the general expression for the capacity of a quantum channel with quantum effects taken into account. And this is no longer true because there are no physicists who understand information theory. It was a much harder problem than John Pierce thought it was. And the second point I want to make, and this might, as the state of information theory in 1973 was one of, well, we've done all the interesting things, but now, the field is kind of dead because we've proved all the interesting theorems and there's nowhere to go. And of course, this was completely, a completely wrong forecast of the future, because shortly after 1973, people began developing, computers got faster, people began developing modems. All of this data communication uses all sorts of information theory, which isn't just, it's not just that they've taken the theory that existed in 73 and applied it to practice. There's been a lot more fundamental theory developed because of interaction with practice. So right now we're in the state of quantum computing, way before 1973. But I think that, when quantum computers are developed, they're going to generate a lot more theory. Okay, so before I can actually get to information theory, I want to say more about quantum mechanics. So far in the summer school, most of the talk has been about pure states, and for quantum information theory, you really need to consider density matrices, which are mixed states of quantum systems. So one way that density matrices arrive is with probability distributions over pure states. And what is a density matrix? Well, if you have an n-dimensional quantum system, it's a Hermitian trace one positive semidefinite matrix. And a rank one density matrix corresponds to a pure state, and here's how you get density matrices. So suppose you have a quantum system which is in state V sub I with probability P sub I. The density matrix corresponding to it is rho, which is summation over I, pi, vi, vi dagger. And here, if there's only one state, which is in with probability 1, you get the density matrix VIVI dagger, which is rank 1 and corresponds to the quantum state V sub I, which is a pure quantum state. And if you have more than one state in this probability distribution, which is also called an ensemble by physicists, and which I will be calling an ensemble, then you're going to get a mixed state, which is a state with density matrix with rank higher than 1. And one very interesting thing about the density matrix is it gives us as much information as possible about the outcomes of experiments performed on the system. So suppose you have two systems and they have the same density matrix, which is, you can get the same density matrix by putting together pure states in a number of different ways. For example, if you mix two orthogonal states, they always give the, identity matrix, or actually half the identity matrix because of normalization. So two systems with the same density matrix, there's no experiment which can tell those apart. Unless you have additional information about one of the systems, like how it was prepared. So, So that's the first way of getting density matrices. The second way of getting density matrices, which if you believe in the Church of the Larger Hilbert space, is the only way of getting density matrices, but is if you have a joint quantum system, which is, say, a tensor product of two systems in the state rho AB. If you throw away the second part, then the first part looks like it's in the state you trace out the second part, rho AB, and this is what it means if you to trace out the second part. So here is a tensor product matrix. Tracing out the first part, tracing out A, you just add these diagonal elements. Tracing out the second part, you take the trace of all the subblocks. And of course, these are the same under these are the same things. They just look different because of the way we've expressing this tensor product. Okay. So we'll get back to density matrices and we'll be using them extensively in my talk. But now what I want to do is talk about entropy, because entropy is really a fundamental property of information theory, and it's also a fundamental property of physics. And there's a story that when Shannon, was developing information theory, he came across this expression. What's the expression? Summation minus pi log p sub I, where you have a probability distribution p sub I. And he asked von Neumann what he thought he should call it. And von Neumann said, well, you should call it entropy, because it's entropy. So, if you have an entropy of a density matrix, rho, well, von Neumann had worked out from thermodynamic arguments several years before that the entropy should be minus trace rho log rho. And if you have a diagonal matrix, the entropy is just the minus pi log pi for the diagonal entries. And in fact, it's generally true, of course, that the von Neumann entropy of rho is a Shannon entropy of the eigenvalues of rho. So there's a little bit of intuition as to why, von Neumann entropy. Well, this is intuition given from assuming you know all about Shannon entropy. So in the classical case, if you have n photons and they're either vertical or horizontal, with probability 1/2, well, there are 2 to the n possible states. Each of them is, any two of these states are completely distinguishable, and the entropy is n bits. In the quantum case, if you have n photons, either in the state or, say, vertical or slightly tilted, with probability 1/2. Well, it's no longer true that any two of these states are distinguishable. In fact, many of them are going to be barely distinguishable if the angle is small.
So intuitively, the entropy should be much less than n bits.
And that's what happens when you, when you calculate the von Neumann entropy of this. So now I think we have enough background to go into, the information theory part of the talk. So, in Shannon's 1948 paper contained two theorems. The first was source cutting, a source X, which means that you have something that's emitting signals, and say it emits, signal 1 with probability P1, 2 with probability P2, etc. So that gives you a probability distribution, and you'd like to compress it for sending the data or storing it or something. So the source X can be compressed to length H of X. And if it's a memoryless source, H of X is very easy to compute. It's just the Shannon, it's the formula for Shannon entropy. And the channel coding, a noisy channel N has the capacity of this I of the mutual information between the input and the output. So N of X is the output of the channel and X is the input of the channel. And what you do is you maximize over all probability distributions for the input. And so the mutual information between X and Y is defined as, it's the entropy of the input plus the entropy of the output minus the entropy of the joint distribution. And that is equal to the entropy of the output minus the entropy of the output given the input. And remember these two formulas because we'll see both of them in the quantum setting, and it will no longer be true that they're equal. So the first thing I want to do, though, is talk about source coding. So what is source coding? This is a little bit of a quick proof. So suppose you have a classical source that emits symbols S1, S2 through Sn with probabilities P1, P2 through Pn. Consider a sequence of n symbols coming from this source. There's something called a typical sequence, and that means as close to n times p sub I for each symbol s sub I. So a typical sequence has roughly the right number of symbols, plus or minus some error factor, how much allowance you make for fluctuations is part of your parameters of your typical sequence. But the theorem is that almost all the time, the source emits the typical sequence. And you can count, and there are going to be 2 to the n times the entropy of the source plus a little bit typical sequences. And that means if you number your typical sequences, 1, 2, 3, 4, up to 2 to the n, h of the Shannon entropy of x, you can take the first n symbols, figure out the number of the typical sequence, just send the number to the receiver, and he then can reconstruct the typical sequence, and almost all of the time, this works. And if your sequence isn't a typical sequence, you can just send the whole thing, and your average number of, the average number of symbols, number of bits you've sent, is just n times the Shannon entropy. So now you can ask, what about quantum states? Suppose you have a quantum source. Can you do the same thing? And if it's the theorem of Van Schumacher, you can. So here what we're doing is we're given a memoryless source, and what memoryless means is that which signals the ith signal is doesn't affect the probabilities of the I plus first signal. So given a memoryless source that outputs pure states V1, V2, V3 with probabilities P1, P2, P3, etc.,
Well, what you'd like to do is you'd like to take the source, compress it, send it to the receiver over a channel that transmits qubits, and have them, you know, uncompress it, decode it, and get the same sequence. Well, you can't quite do that. But what you can do is you can send n symbols using n times the entropy of rho plus a little bit of qubits, and instead of having him get the right sequence all the time, receiver gets a state which has fidelity with the original state approaching 1 as n, that the block length goes to infinity. And what fidelity means is that any test the receiver does on the source, on the on his reconstructed data, will almost with very high probability give the same answer as the test would have done on the original sequence. So instead of getting a totally identical sequence, he gets one which is almost indistinguishable from the original sequence. So, well, that's the theorem. And the next slide is going to be the proof. And I'm going to, this is the last, no, this is not the last, this is the hardest proof I'm giving in this talk. So, you can concentrate for a little while or you can sleep. So typical sequences, we're going to use typical subspaces. So we have states V1, V2, up through VK, which live in the tensor product of these n symbols, and there are probabilities P1, P2, up through PK. So we have a density matrix that corresponds to this source. And the density matrix, of course, is summation bi pi vi vi dagger. And this density matrix has eigenvectors, and each eigenvector has an eigenvalue which we'll consider a probability. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at the typical sequences of eigenvectors of the density matrix. So the typical subspace is just the subspace generated by typical sequences of these eigenvectors of the density matrix, which I'm calling V1 hat, V2 hat, through VK hat. And there's no reason this K should equal this K. And in general it won't, because you could have a source that emits more, let's call this K prime. Okay. So, the typical subspace S is spanned by orthogonal typical sequences. The typical sequences orthogonal be all the typical sequences of eigenvectors are orthogonal because any two of these eigenvectors are orthogonal. So that means that it has dimension just the number of eigenvectors, which is 2 to the h von Neumann of rho. So now we want to go back to Schumacher compression. Well, we have states V1 through VK with probability P1 through PK. And how do you compress? Well, you project this, state V1, tensor V2, tensor V3, tensor VK onto your typical subspace. And most of the time, the state gets projected onto the typical subspace. What you're really doing is you're measuring whether the you're measuring this thing in a von Neumann measurement with outcomes, the typical subspace and the perpendicular subspace. Most of the time you'll get it projected onto the typical subspace, and I'll say why later. And if it gets projected onto the typical subspace, you can now send it using the number of qubits which is equal to log of the dimension of the typical subspace, and that's n H von Neumann of rho, which is just what we wanted. And if you don't get it projected on the typical subspace, well, you've ruined your source, and it's irrecoverable. But luckily, this happens very rarely. So even when you've ruined it, the fidelity, when you know Bob measures and tests whether it's whether it would pass the test that the original source would pass, then it's still, this happens so rarely that the fidelity still goes to 1. So why does Schumacher compression work? Well, here's an intuitive proof. You need to put a little bit more estimates and stuff in to make it a real proof. But recall that the density matrix determines the outcome of any experiment. So these eigenvectors v1, v2 hat, v2 hat through vk hat, with probably t1 through p2 through pk hat prime, give us, if those had been the source rather than the real vector, real source, they would give the same probability of outcomes. And we know from the classical theory of typical sequences that the probability of a no outcome, if you tested whether these sequences were typical, would be very small. So that means that the probability of no outcome is also small with VI and PI. And now you're doing it now because you're projecting onto a typical subspace, and almost all the time you project something into the typical subspace, that shows that you don't disturb this vector very much when you project it in, because it has to have been very close to the typical subspace to begin with to project in nearly all the time. So that means that this coding method gives high fidelity. So that is source coding, and that was one of the first results in quantum information theory. And I wanted to put up. And now what I want to do is talk about channel coding. So channel coding, a noisy channel, has capacity for the maximum mutual information. And now you can ask, well, what happens when you go to quantum channels? And actually what we're going to talk about is quantum sources right now. So suppose you have a source that outputs the signal rho sub I, and here this is no longer a pure state, although you should probably think of it as being a pure state, because that gives you the most intuition with probability p sub I. You can ask, how much information can you extract about the sequence of I? So if you let x be the random variable telling which signal rho sub I was sent, what classical information theory tells you to do is optimize over all possible measurements m on the signals with outcomes m1, m2, etc. So that means the accessible information, this is what this is called, the accessible information for an ensemble of states rho sub I with probability p sub I, is a maximum over all possible measurements of the mutual information between the signal and the measurement. And what does this mean in practice? Well, suppose you have two states in the ensemble, V1 and V2, and they are, photon polarizations with an angle of theta between them. Then the density matrix is this guy, and the von Neumann entropy is H of 1/2 plus cosine theta over 2. Now, you can ask, well, what measurement gives you the best distinguishing of this? Best ability to distinguish between this guy and this guy, or rather the maximum mutual information, which is the information theory best distinguishability thing, and you can show that it's the von Neumann measurement, which either projects it onto this vector or this vector, where these vectors are centered symmetrically about these two states. And the accessible information turns out to be 1 minus h of 1/2 plus sine theta over 2. and you notice that this guy is actually different from this guy, which, I mean, using classical information theory as an analogy, you'd think that this would be the right answer. But this is less than you could see if I had the graph, which is supposed to be one of these slides, but I don't have it, that the information, accessible information, is strictly less than the von Neumann entropy. Okay, so next I want to, to do the next example, I need to talk about POVM measurements. I'm not sure that everybody, that they were covered in the summer school, so here's a slide. They probably were they? No. Oh, okay. So what's a POVM measurement? Well, actually, maybe I should go over von Neumann measurements first, because this gives the von Neumann measurement and the form for which the POVM measurement is analogous. So suppose you have a quantum state space C to the n. A von Neumann measurement is just a complete set of orthogonal subspaces S1, S2 through Sk, which need not be, you know, these are not necessarily one-dimensional subspaces, but they're all, you know, any pair of them are orthogonal, and complete means that they span the whole space. Now, if you let pi sub Si be the projection onto the ith subspace, the von Neumann measurement, you know, what it does is it takes a density matrix rho to its projection onto the subspace, which is pi S sub I rho pi sub Si, with probability, which is equal to the trace of pi sub S sub, pi S sub I rho. So that's the probability. So what happens is when you make the measurement, the density matrix rho is projected onto one of the subspaces, and it's projected onto the ith subspace with probability this guy. And the simplest situation is that each of the SIs are one-dimensional, and then what happens is that you know, S sub I is VI, VI Geiger, and the VIs are an orthogonal basis of vectors for the C sub S for Hilbert space. So a POVM, well, what happens is you're given a set of positive semi-definite matrices satisfying that there's sum of all of these is the anemone matrix. And the fact that there's sum of the anemone matrix for projectors just means that they're all orthogonal and that they span C to the N. The probability of the ith outcome is Pi times trace of E sub I, or trace of E sub I rho. So for von Neumann measurements, E sub I equals pi times S sub I. And actually, the measurement itself doesn't specify what happens to rho after you make the measurement. This formulation of the measurement just gives you the probabilities of the different outcomes, and there are various things you can do. There are various ways of making the measurement, and they will give various outcomes of what happens to the state rho after the measurement. And to obtain the maximum information, if you're making a measurement, you can assume that the E sub I's are all pure states. Because if the E sub I's aren't pure states, there's still some quantum information left in the state. So the second example, suppose you have three signal states which differ by 60 degrees, and your source is emitting them with probability 1/3. So these are their vectors numerically. The optimum measurement is POVM. That means positive operator valued measurement, which corresponds to the three vectors. Well, each E sub I corresponds to WI Geiger normalized by 2/3. And you take the three vectors which are perpendicular to your three signal states. So that means if you started with this guy, you'd never actually observe this guy, because this is perpendicular to this, which means you don't observe it. But you observe this guy half the time, and this guy half the time. So that means that each outcome rules out one state and leaves the other two equally likely. And that means that the accessible information is log 3, because you started out with 3 possibilities, minus log 2, because you started out, you know, end up with 2 possibilities. And the von Neumann entropy is 1, and again, we have the accessible information is strictly less than the von Neumann entropy. And you might think that this is a theorem, and in fact, it was one of the first theorems of quantum information theory. And what it says is, suppose you have a source that emits rho sub I with probability p sub I, and you compute this quantity chi, which is the von Neumann entropy of the average signal minus the average von Neumann entropy of a signal. So this is the entropy of the average output minus the average entropy of an output. That's the generalization of one of these formula for classical mutual information. So the theorem that Haleva proved is that the accessible information is less than chi. And this is, there's equality if and only if all of the rho sub I's commute. So now let's go to channel capacity. Get back to channel capacity. So we have these three signal states that differ by 60 degrees. You can ask, suppose I'm given a box and I have 3 buttons on it, and I can, at each time step, I push one of these 3 buttons, and Bob is at the end of the channel, and, you know, each of these buttons corresponds to a state. What's the maximum information I can send across the channel by pushing these buttons on the box? And the intuition from classical information theory, you might think that this maximum is log 3 minus 1. But this is wrong. And this is a very, you know, Haleva observed this not long after 1973. So suppose we use the 3 code words, V1, V1, V2, V2, V3, V3. So all the time, I push one button, I push it again the next time step, and then I push another button twice, etc. So these are 3 code words. So these are just signals, or states, in a 4-dimensional space, because we had, you know, it's the tensor product of 2 qubits, and they actually live in a 3-dimensional subspace of this 4-dimensional space, because there's only 3 of them. And they're symmetric, so they look like these 3, you know, like these 3 fingers here, and you can show that the optimal measurement for these 3 states is you just pull them farther apart and to form a basis, and then you measure this in the basis. That's okay, and this optimal measurement is 1.369 bits, which is larger than twice log 3 minus 1. So this is the best way to send signals, and this is not the best way to send signals, this is a better way to send signals with this channel, is you string together the code words, or states, and then do a joint measure, and you just use some of these states, which you can call code words, and then you do a measurement that distinguishes all these code words. And, well, you might hope that in the limit, you know, the of longer and longer code words, the information you can send goes to the to this Haleva bound. And in fact, it does. So the classic, so this is a theorem of proved by Haleva, and simultaneously by Schumacher and Westmoreland, is that the classical capacity obtainable using code words given, composed of given signal states rho sub I, and you have to send rho sub I with probability p sub I, is chi of rho sub I p sub I, which is this, the entropy of the average output minus the average entropy of the output. So you can ask, well, I was wrong the first time. That wasn't the capacity of a quantum channel. Is this the capacity of a quantum channel? And, or rather, the capacity being the maximum of chi of the output of the channel with probability distribution p sub I over all output states you can achieve. Okay, well, is it? The answer is we don't know. But I can tell you what we have so far. So this was our first try, and actually I think this was the first, first thing information theorists thought of, is you have a bunch of signals, you send them through a noisy channel, you have a bunch of, outputs, and now you measure them, you get a, bunch of measurement outcomes, and you receive the message. So this is the maximum accessible information over all, all channel inputs and all probability distributions over channel inputs. And that is actually strictly less than this guy. So now here what we're doing is we're still sending in the inputs separately, but we're doing a joint measurement on the output. And this, by the holy of Schumacher Westmoreland, this capacity is the maximum over all probability distributions on possible channel inputs of this formula chi. But there's something else we could do. We could put entangled inputs to the channel and get entangled outputs out. And this is the most general, most general capacity situation for a quantum channel. And this, we don't know whether this is larger than this guy where we don't have entangled inputs. We know that this is the limit as n goes to infinity of probability, of chi of the tensor power to n times of rho sub I, and when you maximize it over all entangled inputs on n symbols and probability distributions on those. What we don't know is whether, this Holevo-Schumacher-Westmoreland capacity is additive, so we don't know whether this is equal to the one-shot formula. Okay. So how do we prove this? Well, we're not going to actually prove this, and we're going to sketch the proof of a simple case of this where all of the rho sub i's are pure states. And this was proved earlier by Hausladen, Josa, Schumacher, Westmoreland, and Wooters. So how do you do this? Well, what we're doing, so this theorem is in the situation you're given pure quantum states V1, V2, through VK for use of signals, and then there's a density matrix, rho, which is summation pi, vi, vi dagger, and the theorem is that there are codes such that we send V sub I with probability P sub I, and as you let the block length of these codes get longer and longer, and where the receiver chooses the appropriate decoding observable, the asymptotic capacity of the channel goes to the von Neumann entropy of rho. I don't know what this chi is doing in there. That's not the right notation. We should probably call this the Holevo-Schumacher-Westmoreland. So how do we prove this? Well, what we do is we use three arguments and our three techniques and then a lot of a calculation. So the three techniques are random coding, which comes from classical information theory, typical subspaces, which are related to typical sequences, which come from classical information theory, and this thing which has been called the pretty good measurement, which is also called the square root measurement, and I'll explain all of these to you. So what's random coding? Well, instead of sending all possible, we want to pick some code words, and we're only going to use these code words and not use all possible sequences of n code words, or of n symbols, sorry. So how do we choose the code words? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to pick V sub I with probability P sub I and just take the tensor product of a whole bunch of different random choices, and that's our first code word. Then we're going to use another code word, and we're going to go up to 2 we're going to go up to 2 to the Von-Neumann entropy of rho minus a little bit over. So 2 to the Von-Neumann entropy of rho times n. Here, let's put that down. 2 to the H Von-Neumann of rho times n minus a little over n code word. Well, the first thing we show is that this code word, actually it follows from the theorem on source coding, this code word is very close to the typical subspace of rho to the tensor product to the n. And so to decode, what we do is we first project into the typical subspace, and then we apply this thing called the square root measurement, or the pretty good measurement. And the square root measurement, well, we have these 2 to the entropy of rho code words, and I'm going to call that number n. So we have these n vectors, u sub I, in the typical subspace, and we're sending them with equal probability 1 over n, because that's the way we're doing the coding. And we want to distinguish, we want to show that there's a measurement which identifies which one of these we sent with high probability. Well, the measurement is this P of the M, which is, suppose we let phi be the sum over I of u sub I dagger. Well, this pretty good measurement is 5 to the minus 1/2 times ui dagger 5 to the minus 1/2. And you can show this is a P of the M because, well, the condition for it to be a P of the M is that the sum of all the u sub i's is equal to 1. So the sum of these e sub i's is the sum 5 to the minus 1/2 times ui dagger 5 to the minus 1/2. But ui dagger sum to phi, so this is just equal to the identity. So we're done. And now we need to show that the probability of error if the state u sub I is sent is, well, we know it's 1 minus u sub I dagger 5 to the minus 1/2 u sub I, and we want to show that the overall probability of error is small, and that's calculation, and very nice calculation, but I don't really have time to go into it right now. What I want to do in the remainder of the talk is talk about entanglement-assisted capacity. But before I do that, I know people went over teleportation and superdense coding, right? So here's teleportation. You take a qubit in unknown state psi, you turn it into two classical bits, and then there's a receiver who, so the sender does a measurement on this qubit and her half of the ETR pair, and then the receiver does one of four different Pauli matrices to his half of the ETR pair, and you end up with a qubit in state psi. And what we're really more interested in is superdense coding. And superdense coding, you start with two classical bits and one of the EPR pair, and half of an EPR pair. You do one of either the identity or the three Pauli matrices, send that to the receiver, and you get the receiver now measures, and these four different signals are all orthogonal, so you can get two classical bits out. So suppose you have a noisy quantum channel n. Well, you can recall that from superdense coding, if n were a noiseless quantum channel, the sender, Alice, could communicate twice as much classical information to Bob if she shares EPR pairs with him than if they don't. So the question is, how does this generalize to noisy channels? So we call this quantity the entanglement-assisted capacity, and we'll denote it by C sub B. Sorry. So here is the formula for entanglement-assisted capacity. So this is, oh boy, So this is really, well, what we're going to do is we're going to maximize over pure state rho, where rho is a pure state in the tensor product of the input space of the channel and a quantum space that Alice keeps. So what you get is the maximum, this formula is the maximum of rho of Alice's part of rho. Well, so she, Alice sends rho through the channel. This would really help if I had a little diagram. So here's rho, here's Alice. And she has a reference system up here. She keeps, and then she sends it through the channel, and you get N of rho here. And now we have an entangled state between here and here. So the capacity is the entropy of this side of the state, ignoring this side. So when you trace out half of this, you get a density matrix here. So the entropy is this side. So the entanglement system capacity is the entropy of this one plus the entropy of this one minus their joint entropy. And if you, you know, it turns out you don't, doesn't matter which reference system you use or how you purify rho into this reference system, as long as you have the same rho, state rho here, the entropy of the purification is still the same because all purifications behave the same way. So you can just maximize over density matrices rho and not over purifications as I did here. So this is the entropy of the output plus entropy of the input plus the entropy of the output minus the joint entropy. So this is what is, well, what people are calling the quantum mutual information. And how do you prove this? Well, I'm only going to prove the lower bound. I'm going to show a protocol which, you know, you can achieve this. And this protocol is, okay. I just discovered this a couple of weeks ago. We had a much more complicated proof earlier. So it's nice having a proof that I can actually give in a talk. So what we're going to do is we're going to use the Hoyle-Schumacher-Westmoreland theorem to prove the lower bound. So what we have is Alice is going to send, well, Alice and Bob share these states, these entangled states, and I'll use specific entangled states. And what Alice is going to do is send something through Bob to the channel, and then Bob is going to get a signal, and the signal is going to consist of the entangled part, his half of the entangled states, plus the output of the channel. And you can just apply the Hoyle-Schumacher-Westmoreland formula to these guys, which is, you know, these are the signals Bob is receiving, and calculate the entangled system capacity that way. So what happens is for each channel use, I should say channel use, not here, not signal. Alice and Bob start with M entangled states phi, with Alice's half of phi being in the state rho, which maximizes the formula for entanglement assisted capacity. So here's another way of expressing the formula for entanglement assisted capacity. It's maximum over all rho, h of rho plus h of n of rho, which is rho sent through the channel, minus the entropy of the joint state when Alice sends a purification of rho through the channel. So I need to put down here that the trace, when you trace out half of phi, you get rho. Okay. So for each channel use, Alice and Bob are going to start with M entangled states phi, where Alice's part of phi is in rho, and we might as well assume rho is diagonal, and I'll assume if the rho is a qubit, although the same proof works for general, no, d-dimensional signal state. And assuming that rho is diagonal is just the same as changing the basis, so you can always assume rho is diagonal. So what Alice is going to do is choose one of these M states and either apply the identity or sigma z to it, and send it through the channel. So what happens when she applies either the energy or sigma z to it, as if you just look at, if you average over those two, what she's done is she's disentangled her state from Bob. So now they're correlated states because, you know, there's probability of alpha that Alice and Bob both have a zero, and a probability 1 minus alpha they both have a 1, so they're correlated, but there's no longer any quantum entanglement between them. At least there isn't if Bob doesn't know which one of these Alice did. So the Holevo-Schumacher-Westmoreland theorem says that the capacity is equal to the entropy of the average signal minus the average of the entropy of a signal. So what's the average entropy of a signal? So what does Bob see? Well, he has one of these states Alice has sent through the channel, so he has both halves of that. So that gives him this term, the entropy of, phi when half of it has been sent to the channel and he kept the other half. And then he has n minus 1 states where Alice kept her half of the state. So those are all in, those all have the entropy h of rho. So now the next question is, what's the average thing he sees? Well, remember, Alice disentangled her states from Bob. So first, he has n states, each of which has entropy h of rho. And now, he has the stuff that Alice sent to the channel. And what Alice knows, and because we're averaging over them, Bob's states are disentangled from Alice. So Alice has, we're going to break it up into the case where Bob has k zeros and n minus k ones. If Bob has k zeros and n minus k ones, Alice is sending a density matrix which has probability k over n of being a zero and 1 minus k over n of being a 1 through the channel. And she does that with probability n choose k, alpha to the k, 1 minus alpha to the n minus k. And this term, as n gets big, goes to the entropy of n of rho, because the guy inside is going to, the guy being sent through the channel is going to rho with almost certainly. So you subtract this from this, you get 1 h of rho, 1 h of n of rho, which is this term, and the entropy of the joint state. So this is entanglement assisted capacity. And so here, you think we're being very, very wasteful of entangled states, because to get, to reach C sub E, Alice and Bob are using n entangled states for each signal, and they're sending one to the channel and throwing away the n minus one, other n minus one. But one nice thing about this is Alice can reuse the states. How is this? Well, after Bob decodes one block, what Bob is really doing, Alice and Bob are really doing, are using the Holevo-Schumacher-Westmoreland protocol for coding. And what happens is they use they use long blocks of code words. And Bob has a measurement, which is a little bit complicated, but he almost certainly figures out which signal Alice sent. And if he figured out which signal Alice sent, he knows exactly which of the states by she sent to the channel and which ones she kept. So now that he knows which ones she kept, he can reuse those for the next block because they're all untouched. So he only really needs to use one of these states by for each channel use. So we used supposed to be an H and not an M. It's an entropy of rho entanglement per channel use. So here I'm going to close this part of the talk, and I have two more slides after this. So the conjecture is that the entangled system capacity if you have a bound on entanglement per channel, is this formula, which is the maximum over P sub I and rho sub I of the it's the average entropy of the input plus the entropy of the average output minus the average joint entropy. And, well, we have a bound of, if we have, are allowed E amount of entanglement per channel use, what you do is you maximize over P sub I and rho sub I, where the rho sub I are constrained so that the average entropy of rho sub I is E. Okay. And I believe, although I have to write down and make sure that it works, that we have a proof of this for unentangled inputs per channel. And one of the nice things about this formula is that if E is, as E gets large, it goes to the entanglement of the capacity. And as E goes, when E equals zero, this turns into the Hoelewell-Schumacher-Westmoreland theorem. And remember, the Hoelewell-Schumacher-Westmoreland theorem gave this bound as long for channel capacity as long as you weren't allowed to use entangled inputs. So we proved it for the same case that Hoelewell-Schumacher and Westmoreland have. So two more slides. I haven't talked at all about sending quantum information through a channel. Suppose you have a quantum state and you have a quantum channel and you want to get the quantum state to a receiver. Well, it turns out that you can do this over noisy channels by using quantum error correcting codes, which Maddie Neal talked about. I think, yeah. And there's some capacity formula for quantum information. And the conjecture is that the amount of quantum information you can get through a channel is the limit as n goes to infinity, 1 over n times this thing called the coherent information of the tensor of n channel uses. And the coherent information is just the entropy of maximum over rho of the entropy of the output minus the entropy of the joint state. So it's the same as the entanglement is just the capacity, except you've left out the first term. And one of the things about coherent information is that there are many channels for which the coherent information is zero. And for these channels, you can't send any, for these channels, the conjecture is you can't send any quantum information. In fact, you can't send any quantum information through these because coherent information has been shown to provide an upper bound for the quantum channel capacity. What we don't know is whether it's achievable. So, okay. We have a list of open questions. Okay, so the first is, do we really need entangled inputs? And that comes down to, is the Hoelewell-Schumacher-Westmoreland capacity additive? And a lot of people have been thinking about it, and nobody has solved this, so I assume it's hard. Second thing is quantum capacity given by the coherent information? And now that we've discovered this new formula for entanglement-assisted capacity with a bound on the entanglement, you can ask whether this is additive. So that's harder than the first question. And at this conference, I've been talking with Charlie, and we came up with a couple of interesting questions. One is, characterized channels such as a Hoelewell-Schumacher-Westmoreland capacity is equal to the entanglement-assisted capacity. So some of these channels can send quantum information, but if you restrict these channels to the support of, this counterexample I came up with that Charlie, or this, I should say pathological channel I came up with that Charlie told you about this morning, what happens is that it has two modes, and you can send one mode, it's completely classical, the other mode sends quantum information, but the quantum information mode is small enough that it doesn't add, using it, doesn't add to the, doesn't add to the entanglement assisted capacity. So if you talk about channels where the rho maximizing entanglement assisted capacity is a full rank in the channel input, I think these channels might just be very classical channels. So that's one open question. Another open question is, can all channels which cannot produce entanglement be simulated by a measurement sending something through a classical channel and by Bob, you know, recreating the original state? Okay, and I think I've used up my time and come to the end of my slides. I think there's one more thing I want to do, which I think we should thank the organizers of this conference. So. Question?